And welcome to the Start Time Podcast with your host, Bran.
And your other host, Dave.
Dave, it is a fantastic time today on the Start Time Podcast. This guy's a legend. Dave?
Yeah, Bran, that's why we got him on, because this is Starry Time.
That's exactly right. Today we have Bruce Maccabee. He has quite the rap sheet in the good kind, not like the bad kind. He has a PhD in physics from the American University, did physics research while employed by the Navy for 36 years. He's now retired, investigated and did historical research into UFO sightings and the phenomena since 1960s. He's written over 100 UFO articles and 6 books, including the one that we're going to focus on the most tonight, which is 3 Minutes in June, which is brand new. It came out this year. Bruce, welcome to the Starry Time Podcast.
Thank you very much. I see the stars are overhead.
That is great news. Bruce, maybe you can just set us up and tell us a little bit about how you got interested in UFOs. Did you have a sighting yourself early on that kind of got you interested in the subject, or how did all that come to be?
Well, growing up in the 1950s, I was mildly aware of stories appearing in the newspaper, but I didn't do anything about it until 59, I guess it was. I read the report on unidentified flying objects, which is a must-read for everybody, by Captain Edward Ruppelt. That sort of sets the foundation for the history of the subject. And I read that, and I at the end of the book, you get the impression he's sitting right on a fence, and it'll only take him hit him with a feather, and you knock him over into the ET side. But he doesn't actually say that. So anyway, I read that book. There wasn't anything I could do about it, so I just put the whole subject aside. I went to Worcester Polytechnic Institute for 4 years, then went to American University in Washington, D.C. And it was while I was in Washington in 1966, 67, 68 time frame that there was a big flap of sightings in the Midwest that caused a lot of discussion about what was going on. Mm-hmm. The Air Force had been running a project called Project Blue Book for many years by that time, and Project Blue Book hadn't come up with any good solution to the sightings, especially the sightings in the 66-67 time frame. Mm-hmm. So the Congress directed the Air Force to support an independent investigation. And that turned out to be an investigation at the University of Colorado. Well, so for a period of time then, legitimate work was going on, and it was okay to talk about UFOs, and you didn't have to have a bag over your head when you did it. I had read in several books about NICAP, National Investigating Committee on Aerial Phenomena, which was headquartered in Washington, D.C., sort of right down the hill from where I was going to school. Two other guys came and gave a lecture at American University, and they said at the end of the lecture, oh, by the way, we could use volunteer help in filing papers and answering letters and stuff like that. Well, I had seen NICAP and mentioned it in a number of books, and there were sightings you'd hear about NICAP investigators going to the scene and so on. So I assumed it was a big organization. I went from American University along Massachusetts Avenue to DuPont Circle in Washington, D.C. You can actually look these places up on GPS. And to a building, it was a row house, 1536 Connecticut Avenue. No longer exists. That is, the building that was there no longer exists. And I went up the stairs, narrow stairs with a little light bulb at the top, still expecting to see a big organization. When I opened the door, I found a room crammed with all sorts of books and papers and junk piled around and so on, and a broken down little old lady running the whole show. Well, it was sort of disappointing, but I could see the files of NICAP. There were 10 filing cabinets or something like that, stocked full with UFO sightings. And I figured if I did some research work for them, they'd let me look at the files, and I could make up my own mind as to what, if anything, was going on. And that's how I sort of got into the subject in an active way. I also joined the local NICAP subcommittee of NICAP, the local Washington, D.C. subcommittee. The subcommittees were the groups of people in various places throughout the United States and the world that actually did the investigations. So I went on some investigations, and the first few investigations I went on, it was not a case of a town drunk or somebody hoaxers or whatever. The first one was a lady who had seen strange green lights going over the car, over the road. She drove along a place not far from Washington, D.C. And she was a teacher, and her husband was an accountant. And there's no way that they were trying to fake something for some reason or other. We never did figure out what that was. In the next couple of years, 70, 71 time frame, I investigated a few other cases that were good, solid cases by the time I got finished. But also, it should be noted that the Conan report was published in 1969. Conan argued that there was no point in having the Air Force continue the Project Blue Book because they weren't learning anything, and they weren't finding any really good evidence of extraterrestrials or anything. It was supposedly all explainable. Hmm. Even though you read the report itself, you found cases in there. You go to the Conan report and look up unexplained cases in the index, and you find something like 30 listed out of 90 cases they tackled. So anyway, when the Conan report was published in early 69... early 69, I guess it was. The news media picked up on Dr. Edward U. Condon's conclusion that there was nothing to it, and the Air Force should get out of it. At that point, the flap that had been going on for the 65-66 time frame was a lot of sightings happening. The number of sightings per unit time dropped off, and by 1970, the general public thought the whole thing was over and done with. There was no more flying saucers. There never had been. Those of us who had our ear to the ground, so to speak, knew that there were sightings coming in, but at a very low level. Yeah. But then all of a sudden in the fall, in the summer, late summer of 1973, we were back, and major cases occurred at that point, which still are investigated today. They were back, and stuff stuck around. And at that point, I decided it was time to get really active, and I started investigating some major cases myself, including the photographic case, the only photographic case that was endorsed by the Condon University investigator, William Hartman, was a Trent photo case in McMinnville, Oregon, 1950. And so I took on that to see if I could explain it or unexplain it. And from then on, I did astronaut cases and regular cases, and I handled the New Zealand sightings of 1978. That involved a trip to New Zealand and Australia. And I've tackled a number of cases since then, a lot of them being written up in papers that are in that list of over 100 that are in the biography.
Gotcha. And I think you might have mentioned this in the list that you were talking about, but just to kind of reiterate this and bring it forward to the listeners, so you were one of the first to study the Project Blue Book file of the 13,000 sightings that they were released in the National Archives. But what exactly did you find there in addition? I mean, did this follow the same suit of where they were trying to tell you that there was nothing going on, but you were finding a lot of cases where there was stuff going on that they were almost covering up?
Well, I found some. The Air Force started investigating right off in June or July of 1947 when the subject began. And you may as well ignore Roswell because it played no role in the subject until 1978. By that time, the Air Force treatment of the subject and so on had been cast in concrete, and the Air Force had gotten out of it. But the Air Force began investigating in 1947, at least because their own pilots were witnesses. And of course, they interviewed Kenneth Arnold, who was the guy whose sighting made the press, the first publicized sighting Well, he and his description of the object that were flying and skipping like saucers on the water led to the term flying saucers. The Air Force set up a project called SIGN to investigate these cases in 1947, 48. And then in 1949, they changed the name to Project Grudge. And then in 1952, they changed it to Project Blue Book, which it stayed until 1969. And so what was your question again?
Well, I was asking more along, since you were the first to your
answer. I was setting up the answer. Project SIGN through Project Blue Book ran from 1948 to 1969 when Blue Book closed. Now, all that time, people, if they knew where they could go and read some sightings. But mostly, the stuff was treated as secret, and you needed a clearance to get to the documents. Point being, very few people were able to look through the files of Project Blue Book and find anything, see if they could find anything. That ended in 1975 when the Air Force collected together all their files on UFOs. They collected together and put it into a microfilm roll, which was available in 1976. And there were a few cases that I knew about that I was interested in that I searched for in the microfilm rolls. The microfilm rolls was 98 or something like that, rolls of film encompassing 100,000 pages or something like that, which made up 13,000 sightings reported, of which about 700 the Air Force claimed they couldn't explain. And whenever they said, well, we can't explain that, they would also say, but if we had more information, we could probably have explained it. So they always leave themselves a way out, you might say. Anyway, I was one of the first people to go to the archives and pull these microfilm rolls down off the shelves and stick them in a right microfilm reader and just sort of crank away. It gets pretty dull when you're reading a 100 or so cases in a microfilm roll.
Sure.
More than 100 cases. But
how long does that take to go through one roll?
I don't know. It would be hours to go through a roll, depending on how fast you crank and how fast you can read and so on.
Sure.
If you find something that's really good but meaty, you want to take your time. Now, there was a particular case that I was interested in called the Rogue River sighting, which I knew about, not from anything that I had read except for the so-called Special Report Number 14, which is a Project Blue Book report published in 1954-55, which was a careful analysis by the Battelle Memorial Institute of sightings between 1947 and 52. That period of 5 years, they took these sightings, they got 4,000 sighting reports. I threw away 800 of them to begin with and analyzed 3,200 sighting reports very carefully. And they found some that they couldn't explain at all. And one of them was this Rogue River sighting, which I thought looked pretty good based on the little paragraph that they had in this Special Report 14. And that was one of the ones that I looked for in the microfilm roll. And I found that it had a lot more information on it. Now, in the Project Blue Book, the first roll of film was a tabulation of all the cases, an index to cases, you might say. And if you looked up this particular case called Rogue River in the microfilm roll reels, in the table of contents of the microfilm reel, you found it was claimed that it was a kite they saw. Well, it had a picture with it, and the picture certainly didn't look like a kite. So I rummaged around in more reels of film and just happened to come upon more information on that case, which allowed me to prove beyond all reasonable doubt that it wasn't a kite. But furthermore, it was a strange object, pancake-shaped. Five witnesses saw it. Two of the witnesses looked at it through binoculars, pancake with a raised fin on the back. It approached them, became stationary, rotated about a vertical axis, and took off at the speed of a jet, all with no noise. That was probably within a mile of them. So that sounded pretty like a pretty good case to get. I wrote about it. It's on my website.
Sure. So I imagine. Sorry.
Might mention my website, brumac.mysite.com. Brumac.mysite.com.
Absolutely. Yeah, we'll definitely link that. Moving forward, I imagine we could talk for hours about different sightings that you've investigated, but there's one in particular that you saw interesting or persuasive enough to write an entire book about, and it's about this Kenneth Arnold sighting. It's from your latest book, 3 Minutes in June. So let's talk a little bit about that. Who is Kenneth Arnold? What is the deal with this sighting, and why did you see it so important to write an entire book about it?
Well, as of June 23rd, 1947, no one had ever heard of flying saucers. No one was thinking about weird things flying through the sky, except for the few witnesses who saw weird things flying through the sky. Mainly in the springtime of 1947, but they didn't tell anybody. So there were weird things going on, but only the witnesses knew about it. The general public didn't. And then along comes Kenneth Arnold, a successful businessman who runs a fire control company, and he flies a small airplane to travel from one work site to another. In the areas around the state of Washington, Idaho, and Oregon, and whatever, in the Northwest. He was flying his small plane on part of a business trip when his sighting occurred. And I'll tell you what his sighting was, what he actually saw. But his sighting, because of who he was, his credibility, his capability to be a careful observer, and nobody thought he was going to be making up stories or whatever. What he described to his friends, other pilots, were some objects that were flying in a very strange way and looked very strange shape, I'll tell you about. And his friends, in a sense, they didn't think that he was going to be lying or whatever. They didn't think that he was misidentifying anything. They didn't necessarily believe exactly everything that he said about these things because they were so amazing. But his credibility was good enough so that when he went to a newspaper office, they took his story of seeing objects doing something that nobody had ever seen before. And that story was picked up from a local paper and picked up by national news. And within a few days, he was an internationally known person. In this book, I have studied his case. Oddly enough, although his is the first one that was publicized, it's more than 70 years old now, there hasn't been a book on his sighting. Huh. I don't know why somebody hadn't done it already, but I really didn't think of it from that point of view when I started writing this way back in December. I was saying to myself, well, Kenneth Arnold's sighting is coming up on the 70th anniversary. And that was part of what played into my decision to write about it. The other thing was more more general. I've been studying UFO stuff for 50 years or so, and I felt like I hadn't been getting anywhere with either modern cases or old cases or whatever. So I thought, well, let me go back to the beginning and see what we missed the first time through. I was pretty well familiar with the history. And Kenneth Arnold's sighting, for example, is mentioned in almost every UFO book since it's the first one that was publicized. A lot of people assume it was the first sighting, which it wasn't the first sighting. But it was the first one to be publicized, and that opened the door for other sightings to be publicized in the press. So anyway, I'm thinking, there isn't any book on Arnold, why not do one? I was particularly interested in his sighting itself. I had studied it 20 years before and published some articles in the International UFO Reporter, which is published by the Center for UFO Studies. I had published some articles contradicting the so-called explanations for Arnold's sighting. But I haven't really studied the sighting beyond that. And so I went back and I started reading what he said happened. And there are four different recitations of his sighting in the book. One was on a radio show 2 days after the sighting. Then an article that he wrote, a letter that he wrote to the Air Force a couple of weeks after the sighting. What's in his book, The Coming of the Saucers, was published in 1952, I think. His recitation in that book. And then the final recitation at the Fate, UFO conference put on by Fate magazine in the spring of 1977, Arnold's last public appearance. So I took all these different things about Arnold and I put them into a book, and I did it in a way that nobody else has ever done, what I call analytic history, where you take the story, the history of the sighting, apart and look at each chunk and ask yourself, does this make any sense? The important parts would be major details of the sighting, which are important, especially if you're trying to contradict or throw out explanation. It is a scientific approach to almost any new phenomenon to assume that it's an old phenomenon in some sort of different clothing or whatever, and then try to use what you already know to explain this new phenomenon that you don't know about. But you can, the new phenomenon will have certain number of characteristics about it, which you can compare with the known phenomena, see if there are known phenomena with the same characteristics as the unknown. And that's sort of what I did in this book. And I had help from the skeptics, you might say. The skeptics kept thinking up explanations for Arnold's sighting, starting off with Arnold himself as a skeptic. Arnold was the first UFO investigator. He investigated himself sort of while the sighting was happening. Hmm. He was seeing these objects traveling along as he was heading eastward near Mount Rainier in the state of Washington at 3 o'clock in the afternoon with the sun above and behind him. He saw to his left, far to the north, some flashes of light. And he, as these things got closer, he began to realize he was looking at objects that were, as he said, flipping and flashing in the sun. He compared the way they flew to a saucer, or a stone skipped on the water, or a flat stone, or a saucer skipping on the water.
Hmm.
And these things were tilting back and forth, and he thought reflecting the sunlight from their shiny top surfaces. There were 9 of them. 8 of them were semicircular with a convex triangle at the rear, not a complete saucer. And one of them was had a curved front like a half a plate, but then a double crescent, a double concave crescent at the rear end. There are pictures of it in the book.
These wow. Things
were flipping or tilting left and right, frontwards and backwards, making very violent maneuvers, you might say. And as he looked at these things, he began to realize he couldn't see anything normal. There were no wings. There were no engines. There was no fuselage. There was no vertical stabilizer. There was no tail wing. There was nothing that he recognized as being associated with ordinary aircraft. So the first thing about these was the way they flew, flipping and flapping and so on. The next thing was that he realized that they had this weird shape. It didn't look like anything he'd ever seen before or heard about. And as he saw them coming from the left-hand side in the north, his first thought was he could see they were in a chain. The lead one was up high, and then the following ones were lower down. And it was jiggling back and forth like a chain of geese was his first thought. And then he realized they couldn't be geese because they were going too fast.
Hmm.
Well, he could see as these things traveled along that they were going to go between him. If they went in a straight line, they would go between him and Mount Rainier. And he says in one of his reports, you know, pilots are always talking about how fast their aircraft are and how well they work and all that sort of stuff. And so they're interested in the capabilities of aircraft. And it occurred to him, and he's flying at 9,200 feet above sea level, about 20 to 25 miles southwest of Mount Rainier. Mount Rainier is 14,400 feet high, twice as high as the nearby mountain peaks, about 7,000 feet. So it sticks right up as a good signpost. And far to his right was Mount Adams and Mount St. Helens, the southern state, I guess they're in the state of Washington, 50 miles south of where he was at Mount Rainier. And Mount Adams stands up 10,000 feet, so it stands up above the surrounding mountains. So he had geographical reference points that he could use. His first thought was, I wonder how fast those things are going. And then he looks at the scenery and he says, well, I can make a guess. I can make a measurement of time that when it goes past Mount Rainier. I have a dashboard clock. It reads 1 minute before 3 o'clock as they are going past Mount Rainier. And I'll just watch them as they go south. And when they get to Mount Adams, I'll look at my clock again. Essentially, that's what he did. Came up with 102 seconds to go from Mount Rainier to Mount Adams. And he thought that was pretty fast, but at the time he was watching it, he didn't really know how fast. He turned his plane and traveled in the direction of the objects southward for a short distance. He rolled down his, or opened up his window, and so there was no glass between him and them, no chance for misidentification due to glare or window reflection or whatever. And he also did one other thing. He could see them silhouetted against the side of Mount Rainier as they were traveling along at high speed. And he made an angular size comparison by holding a thing known as a Zeus fastener that holds a cowling or cover on top of the engine. He held this Zeus fastener up at these objects, and he had previously spotted a DC-4 passenger plane heading northward, perhaps to San Francisco, not San Francisco, to Seattle, at his right, at his left. And he compared the size of the objects with the size of this airplane and decided it might be these objects from front to back are about 60 feet. My own suggestion is it's probably more like 80 to 100 feet, but in any case, the point is that he got an angular size you could work with, some sizable objects. So he made these two measurements, and I pointed out in the book that he was the right guy at the right time, at the right place, with the right attitude. He was a scientifically oriented person, an engineer-type guy. He was at the right place because he could watch these objects all the way from far north down to far south, and track them in the right time, because if he had been there a few minutes earlier or a few minutes later, they would have been past him, or he would have gone past Mount Rainier so far headed eastward that he was would no longer see them going south. Anyway, there's also the right attitude. Most people seeing something like this would sit there in their airplane with their chin on the floor, maybe saying, "Wow, those things are fast." And then after it's all over, they say, "Gee, I wonder how fast that was." And they tell their friends, "Well, I saw something that moved pretty damn fast and did these weird things on." Huh. And his friends would say, "Yeah, sure. Tell us another one." But now he had measurements. He made two measurements. And that sets us aside because it was, in particular, the speed measurement. When he calculated it out, when he found out how far apart Mount Rainier and Mount Adams were, he determined the they were going like 1,700 miles an hour. After he managed to talk himself into saying maybe it was as low as 1,200 miles an hour, but anyway, they were going faster than any jet that we knew about at that point. Chuck Yeager broke the sound barrier in September of 1947 at 760 or something like miles an hour. And these objects were already going 500 or 1,000 miles an hour faster. So anyway, Arnold had been on a business trip. He was heading back to Yakima, Washington, from a place called Chehalis. He had just completed a turn over Mineral, Washington, and was heading eastward when this sighting occurred. And then he continued on to Yakima, where he told his friends. And then he flew to Pendleton, Oregon, flew westward to Pendleton. And by the time he got there, his story had been made into some, the news media knew about it. And the next day, his story was publicized. And the thing that they always picked up on was the 1,200 miles an hour claim that these things traveled at. And that's what made it go around the world, you might say. His story, when publicized, was that these weird objects were traveling along at an extremely high rate of speed. And no sooner did they make it into the press than other people started coming forward saying, hey, we saw some weird stuff too. And now another thing I should say about this book, it talks about other sightings beside Arnold's on the 24th of June. His sighting was 24th of June at 3 o'clock. There were other sightings that day of flashing lights moving through the sky. And in particular, one sighting in particular is of extreme importance. That was the Fred Johnson, the prospector, sighting. He was prospecting on the side of Mount Adams at an altitude of 5,000 feet, he said, when all of a sudden there was a flash of light on something or other, on the rocks or whatever, that attracted his attention. He looked up in the sky and he saw these five or six sort of like circular objects tilting back and forth and zipping along at a high speed with a sort of a appendage sticking out the back end that was swinging back and forth. He said, like a big magnet. And he said that not only did he not hear anything, and he last saw them as they were standing on edge, banking into a cloud, he said. And he noticed that his compass needle wobbled back and forth while these things were present, and after they were gone, the compass needle was steady again. So this is the first case. Kenneth Arnold's case is not the first, well, it was the first one to be publicized, but it's not the first to be the first unidentified case. That belongs
right
to Johnson. Fred Johnson's case is the first one in the Blue Book file of 13,000 cases, the first one to be that they couldn't identify.
And those two stories kind of agree with each other to add credence, right?
Oh, well, Johnson said he saw the same things.
Yep.
At the time that Arnold was losing sight of him.
Right. So that has to be the same exact sighting, just from two different perspectives.
Right. Fred Johnson, he wrote a letter to the Air Force on his own to add credence to the sighting by Kenneth Arnold. And then
right.
The Air Force sicked the FBI on him. And the FBI went and interviewed him and decided he was a very credible person and knew his business. And so,
well, that's the other question I had. So once they released these stories, what is the reaction from the kind of the news and also from the Army and Air Force?
Well, you can see some of the newspaper stories that came out the day after. The day after his sighting, he was interviewed by the local press, and they put out a short story. It went out in the daytime, I guess, or early afternoon. And then they had a more detailed story the next day. And they were emphasizing that these things were not shaped like ordinary aircraft, and that the way they flipped and bounced around and so on, it was like a saucer skipping on the water. Arnold used that as a comparison. And some brilliant reporter decided that that must be what these are, saucers that have skipped along on the water. And so the terminology to refer to them became flying saucers, even though a lot of UFOs are cigar-shaped and other stuff, spheres and so on, they're all nowadays called flying saucers. And the speed that he estimated, as I said, they publicized 1,200 miles an hour, but the actual calculation gives you 1,700. But nevertheless, so fast that it attracted the interest of everybody. Do we really have aircraft that can travel that fast now? You should understand we're right after the Second World War. During the Second World War, there were a lot of technological advances in aircraft and other types of military equipment. And so people seeing strange things up in the sky wouldn't be that necessarily surprised, because they'd probably think it was something that the Air Force was doing. And that was Arnold's first thought, was that he was looking at a new type of aircraft. He couldn't imagine what. He assumed at first it was probably U.S. aircraft. Then he became worried that maybe it was, they were so different from U.S. aircraft, maybe these things were Russian. And for that reason, he quickly went to the FBI. But the FBI office was closed, so he went to a newspaper and told the newspaper. At any rate, for a few days there, the Air Force immediately said it wasn't ours. Hmm. For a few days, the press treated this thing seriously, and the story went around the world. But about 2 weeks afterwards, at that point, there hadn't been any hardware or physical evidence that you can point to. As I said, you can forget about Roswell, because that news story went out on the 8th of July at noon, and was stomped on a few hours later by General Ramey in Texas, and never heard it from again until the 1978-79 time frame. So the people didn't have anything to any hardware to look at or whatever, and the press began to get skeptical about the whole thing. Hmm. And began to treat it ultimately like a silly season.
So you know, you've mentioned Roswell a little bit, which ironically also happened in 1947. There seemed to be a lot of things that were going on in this year around this time. Why do you think that is? Was this just a hot period of time for UFOs, or what was going on that was causing there to be such a amount of sightings and big ones, as it were?
Well, I won't say that no one knows. I'll say that I don't know, and I'll say that most people don't know. There may be somebody who knows why it was that there were things flying through the sky. In 1946, in Sweden, they had so-called ghost rockets flying through the sky, and they never found out exactly what that was all about. And then in the spring of 1947, there were a number of reports that came out after Arnold's sighting was publicized. Other people started reporting sightings. The other people's sightings were, could be after Arnold's, or there were people who reported seeing sighting things before Arnold's was publicized. For example, some meteorologists who ought to know what they're doing, tracking balloons in Richmond, Virginia, saw a spherical object travel past their balloon in April of 1947. They duly noted, and didn't tell anybody. After Arnold's sighting was reported and it was in the press, the Air Force was interested in getting any information they could on these things. Then the people, the meteorologists in Richmond, sent to the Air Force their report. And they said, we would have said something about this before, but we didn't know anybody was interested. So there were a number of sightings, and you can read about it in the book, a number of sightings that occurred before Arnold's. There were 19 other sightings on the 24th of June. Arnold. And by the time two weeks from then, the sighting numbers went up to about 180 in one day, early July, I forget which day it was. There was a big flap of sightings. 800, one guy who collected sightings as he traveled around the United States, checking on newspaper sighting reports in the 1947 time frame, was able to catalog 840 sightings. More recent investigations have suggested there could have been 1,000 or several thousand sightings that just weren't reported very well in the press or in local papers. Couple of thousand sightings in this 1947 flap. Now, why did that occur? I haven't a clue. You have to ask them, I mean the guys upstairs, as to why there was a big flap of sightings in 1947. There was another big flap of sightings in 1952, which I'm writing about right now. 1952 I call the year of the UFO, because the Air Force collected more sightings in 1952 than ever before or after.
There's so many, you know, nowadays it's so easy to fake things. Has there been what you would consider to be a legitimate, another kind of series, a flap, if you will, in modern day, or when do you think the last flap was?
Well, I don't think the flap was a hoax.
Right. No, that's not what I'm saying.
You're talking about involving literally hundreds of people seeing things at various times. But there was a big flap in 1947 that kicked it all off, you might say. Then in 1952, there was a bigger flap. There was another flap in 1957-58 time frame. At 1957, at the time of the launch of Sputnik, there was a flap in the 1965-68 time frame, which is what led to the Condon study. Then everything seemed to quiet down, and UFOs had gone to bed or disappeared. Until all of a sudden, this is in the late summer of 1973, there was this big concentration of sightings in the Midwest. The bulk of the sightings moved from the southwest, or northwest, to the southeast area of the United States. And there were a couple of internationally known sightings that happened there. The Hickson Parker abduction on the Pascagoula River, Pascagoula, Mississippi, in October of 1973, and the helicopter lifting case in Ohio that occurred also in October 1973. After that, there have been big sighting flaps that were the same way, but there were worldwide flaps in 78, 79. Let me see, I know in 1989, 1990, 1991 time frame. Things get more diffuse after that.
Sure. So, talking a little bit more about the Air Force, you know, you talked about the Air Force trying to sweep it under the rug. Can you dive in a little bit more about what you have concluded? Do you think the U.S. government, the military, and maybe even the ETs are all working together somehow? Or do you think it's a separate thing and the government's trying to kind of shield the eyes of people so that we don't know that they exist? Or what's your theory on what's going on there?
Well, I don't know anything about the government colluding with the ETs or whatever. I can't rule it out, the Roswell case to me seems to be pretty strong, but I don't refer to it very much because it's sort of impossible to prove without access to the hardware. The Air Force initially claimed that it wasn't theirs, and then after a few weeks and so on of not finding anything, they said, "Well, we're not finding anything. We don't know what this is." They went ahead and investigated sightings, and we know that by September of 1947, the director of the Air Materiel Command, General Nathan Twining, had put it into a letter to his superior, General Vandenberg, he had put into a letter that he wrote to Air Force Intelligence that whatever it is, flying saucers are real and not visionary or fictitious. In other words, he concluded after several months of investigation that there really was something going on. But that was in a classified letter. Nobody knew about it. The Air Force's public position was, we're not finding anything. There's nothing to worry about. All this stuff can most likely be explained one way or another. And they tried to damp down the enthusiasm, if you can say it, call it that, for reporting sightings. But I should say that this book that I'm doing right now, one reason for reading it, is this build-up to the sighting flap in 1952. The big sighting flap in 1952 took place in June, July, and August. there's a buildup to it. In April of 1952, Life magazine carried an article in which it said that the Air Force was ready to, had decided that it was important to investigate UFOs after all. And they were allowed to look at a lot of UFO sighting reports. And they publicized in the Life magazine that they're based on the Air Force and information collected by the Air Force, there is a case for interplanetary saucers. That was right on the cover of the April 7th, 1952 issue of Life, along with a picture of Marilyn Monroe. And if you get your eyes off Marilyn Monroe, then you can look over a little bit and see it says there is a case for interplanetary saucers.
Wow.
And at that point in late July of 1952, there had been hundreds of sightings all over the world and all over the United States. And if the press, if the Air Force was going to announce that we had interplanetary visitors, that would have been a good time to do it because there was a tremendous amount of sightings that could be used as evidence for the argument that interplanetary visitors are flying around. Instead, at the press conference, the general in charge of intelligence, Air Force intelligence, said it was all hot air. temperature gradients were causing radar beams in the vicinity of the White House to get bent down to the ground and pick up anomalous targets, and that the sightings in the restricted areas around the White House, in particular near the end of July, could all be explained as natural phenomena. And the press suckered for that, I guess you might say. They went back and wrote stories that, according to the general, UFOs were hot air. That firmly established a tradition they had already set up. A tradition had been set up by the Air Force in late 47, 48, 49. But there was nothing to UFO sightings. All could be explained. There was nothing to be afraid about. They had a chance to reverse that tradition in the spring and summer of 1952 with all these sightings. They had a lot of support, you might say, for announcing that there really were interplanetary visitors. Instead, they cast the tradition in stone by saying all sightings could be explained. And we've been living under that tradition ever since. Whenever the Air Force was queried about the subject, they would say, in the 50s and 60s, while Project Blue Book was still going on, the Air Force would say, we have investigated these sightings and we found that we can explain most of them very easily, and we expect we could explain the others if we had more information, and go away. After 1969, when Project Blue Book closed, the Air Force had practically no word at all on UFO sightings. If you contacted the Air Force, they would say, we carried out an investigation for years, we didn't find anything. Go talk to MUFON, go talk to NICAP, go talk to some UFO group, but not us. And that's the same thing that would happen if you wrote to the Air Force today and get back how the Air Force spent a lot of time investigating.
Hello?
Hello.
Sorry, well, we were breaking up there at the end.
Oh, I couldn't tell.
That's okay. We got most of it, so I think...
Right, right.
Yeah, it was just the last couple words.
But to kind of wrap up on that last point...
On the tradition? Did you understand what I was talking about, tradition?
That's the part. Can you just kind of restate the last part that you said about that?
The Air Force had established a tradition, essentially, back in 1947, 48, 49 time frame, a tradition that there was nothing to UFO reports. They could all be explained and go away. And then they had a chance to break through that tradition and admit that there could be interplanetary saucers in the spring and summer of 1962, when there were so many sightings, people wouldn't have been surprised at the airport and said, yep, we got interplanetary visitors. Instead, they cast the tradition in concrete by ignoring all the sightings and saying that everything can be explained. And so we're still living under that tradition.
Right, right. Okay, and so what I want to ask, kind of bringing back what Brand said about bringing this to modern day, what do you see in today's ufology community, the kind of, I guess, the climate there in terms of their ability to share information and putting forth their ideas and theories right now? And in addition to that, kind of, what do you see a day coming where there's going to be full disclosure?
Well, I don't think the Air Force or the government's going to admit to anything until it's proven. And then they'll say, oh, yeah, we know it was real all along. Mm. As for modern-day ufology, people who are just getting started in the field need a lot of history lessons to understand how we got to where we are. And then there are groups that are trying to do instrumented studies. There have been attempts at instrumented studies in the past. Big problem, of course, is you can't predict where there's going to be something happening. So you have to hope that you could hear about some area where there's repeated phenomena of some sort that you can go and measure. I was involved with the Gulf Breeze sightings back in 87, 88, 89, 90 time frame, where there were so many sightings that if you went down the Gulf Breeze, you could almost be guaranteed to see something. I went there in 1991 and saw a ring of lights appear up in the sky. Rings of light aren't supposed to appear up in the sky, but it certainly did. It was, and I didn't immediately call up the guys in the white coats with butterfly nets and tell them to take me away, because other people, 30 other people, saw the same thing I did. It was photographed and videotaped and so on. But you know, if in the modern day people can get their act together and do some instrumented studies, that would be great. Lacking that, you have to cope with how good testimonial evidence is. Most of what we got is testimony. You can compare if you know your history and you know about old sightings, which are in the days when before so much photographic hoaxing and videotape hoaxing and drones and things like that. Put it like this, things were a lot simpler 40 or 50 years ago.
Mm. Yeah. Bruce, thank you. It's been a joy to listen to you talk about all that you've investigated, especially in this case. People can pick up your book, 3 Minutes in June, right now. I believe it's everywhere, like Amazon and all that stuff. They can get it there, and they can check you out. That's Brumac, Brumac, .mysite.com. That's how they can reach you. Is that all right?
That's all right.
Perfect. Bruce, thank you so much for being on. It's been a joy, and we'll talk to you soon, all right?
Okay. Thanks for calling.
You got it. Okay. Big old thank you to Dr. Bruce McAbee for coming on the show. Dave-o.
That was the expert himself. That was the Dr. J of the saucers.
Now, you listen to him talk, and you're like, this guy has been around the block. Like, just like... spouting off dates and like from way before we were born, but just also like he's clearly like done so much research. Mm-hmm. It's like more than we could ever hope. Like we're like, oh, we're 3 seasons into Starry Time, we know what we're talking about. No, be loney.
Yeah, but Bran, that's the start, so we're doing our best. 3 seasons is,
I think, my dream, Dave, is for somebody to invite us onto their podcast and ask us about the things that we've learned.
Well, one day that will be what happens, but we got to keep...
How many seasons do we got
to do? Becoming Bruce's. I think we have to do 57.
57 seasons.
And then they'll invite us on to say, are you excited about 60 coming up?
Oh, man, dude.
But here's the thing. I wanted to say that you know how... there's just the people that can remember dates. I think that also he has going for him, because I don't have that ability.
When were you born?
91.
When's your wedding?
This year.
All right, so you're pretty good.
Yeah, but those are my things. I can't remember. I think I can remember the date. Is your wedding? It's the 16th.
15th.
15th. Yeah, I'm
pretty close.
Even get
of
that
December.
Right.
When was I born?
Well, yeah. Jan 10. No, sorry. Yeah,
yep, Jan 10. You're right. Jan 10. Anyways, for those of you that are listening past the interview and you're still wondering why am I still listening, we'll give you a break. We're out of here. But thank you.
See ya.
Hey, but again, I can't say this enough. We've got to get that star rating up on iTunes. We got to get rid of Alex Norton. So if you could leave us a review and say, hey, they're not as bad as they used to be, that would mean a whole lot. That's it, right, Dave?
Yeah, and also I was going to say, if you think we've gotten worse, you should also leave
yeah.
that feedback.
No, and that's fine. That's totally fair.
Yeah.
I've gotten worse at a lot of things, so it wouldn't be the first time.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Davo, from Greenville, South Carolina.
And from an apple.
This has been the Star Time Podcast with Bran.
And Dave.
Keep searching.
Keep looking up there.